Ladies and gentlemen, another surprise from our good friend and frequent guest of the show, Rich Adam.
That's right. We're releasing the third episode of his wonderfully spooky but narrative journalistic new show, Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf.
Tonight's episode is about Rich's history with Jewel Eisenbud's book, The World of Ted Serios.
Oh, my.
A Chicago bellhop who created images on film with his mind. I'm so envious. Well, we've been meaning to cover Ted Serios for forever.
Yeah.
But I have to admit it. It was Rich that told me about him in the first place a few years ago.
Well, that doesn't stop us. Let's rip him off completely and do it ourselves. Well, it's a different
thing. I know. I think it would actually make him mad.
No, it'll be fine.
All right, remember, folks, Rich has a potty mouth, so in the Astonishing Legends feed, there are some bleeps, but when you subscribe directly to his show, you'll get Rich in all of his uncensored glory.
Wow, imagine that. Well, Astonishing Legends will be back with part two of our series on the elusive force in just a few days, but for now, enjoy episode three of Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and remember to find and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back, and if you're just joining us for the first time, welcome. I want to thank all of you again for the really beautiful responses we're getting on social media, and also the reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or wherever you happen to listen. Susan tells me that those are very important, so if you want to review us, please do hop in there. And most of all, you know what? It tells someone. If you like this and you know someone who you think would like it too, let them know, okay? I mean, not everybody, just, you know, the special people. You know, the ones like, you know, the weirdos. You know what I'm talking about. All right, that's enough of that. Let us begin. Here we go. The World of Ted Serios by Jewel Eisenbud. In order to disprove the assertion that all crows are black, one white crow is sufficient. William James. Today I'm going to talk about Jewel Eisenbud's classic book, The World of Ted Serios. For me, this book has everything. Warring parapsychologists, bizarre phenomena, an alcoholic bellhop, and lots of pictures. I obviously can't show you the pictures, although there will be links in the show notes, but that's okay. I'm going to be describing them. And isn't that really the best use of my time in a podcast? I love this book because it is deeply strange and unsettling and wildly entertaining, and because it breaks my heart. A fitting subtitle might be The Journey of a Parapsychologist, because I feel like this one book, this one case, this one story encompasses the entire emotional experience of being a parapsychologist. Jewel Eisenbud is getting to a point in his life where he feels his work means nothing. He's about the age I am now, and boy, do I know the feeling. He's beginning to question why he's even involved in parapsychology. Then one day, he meets a man who can do the impossible, Ted Serios. Ted, it seems, can think images onto film. Polaroid film, to be exact. So Jewel arranges to meet with him, and over the course of the next 3 years, Jewel goes down a rabbit hole from which he never completely emerged. If the five stages of death are anger, denial, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, then I will submit that there are six stages of parapsychology. They are, in order, curiosity, investigation, doubt, acceptance, James Randi, and depression. So today's episode will follow these stages as they apply to Jewel Eisenbud's experiences with Ted Serios. Let's begin with stage one, curiosity. When I was 12, I wanted to be a parapsychologist. It was 1978, and what no one knew was that parapsychology's best days were already over. I'm speaking about parapsychology as a semi-respectable scientific pursuit. It's always been the drunk uncle of mainstream science, but there have been times and places when reconciliation seemed almost within reach. From 1930 to 1965, J.B. Rhine and William McDougall's parapsychology lab was housed on campus at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Ian Stevenson's Division of Perceptual Studies was established in 1967 at the University of Virginia and is currently helmed by 10 faculty and staff members who, if the website is to be believed, range in hotness from average to extremely. And the University of Edinburgh has something going on called the Kessler Parapsychology Unit, which either studies or fights ghosts, I'm not sure which. But these programs are by far the exception, not the rule. In elementary school, when I was first asked to think about college, I had the vague notion that every university had its own parapsychology department. The faculty would walk around campus in lab coats and only put on the cone-shaped hats with crescent moons and stars once they got inside the lecture halls. To me, it all sounded cool and sexy and mysterious. And isn't that what college is supposed to be? I ended up going to USC Film School and learned different. But deep down, I've always been psi-curious. So was Jule Eisenbud. His curiosity about the paranormal began in childhood, but he didn't make a beeline for Ryan and McDougall's lab. He received a doctorate in medical science from Columbia University and began private practice in psychiatry and psychoanalysis in 1938. By the early 40s, he was part of a seance group that had success in table-tilting experiments. He published papers and gave lectures, usually presenting questions about the paranormal in relationship to his work as a psychoanalyst. And though you might think that no one can predict the future, what happened next was entirely predictable. He was met with hostility from his academic peers. Look, Jule was no kook. He was a button-down academic. He had a razor-sharp mind and an ice-cold sense of humor. But he was willing, hell, he was compelled, to ask uncomfortable questions. In other words, Jule Eisenbud was the perfect parapsychologist. Like anyone in a scientific field who has an interest in the supernatural, Eisenbud faced the challenge of finding a repeatable experiment. This is the white whale, or one might say the white crow, of the field. By 1963, he'd come to the conclusion that a truly repeatable experiment was, quote, inherently impossible. I happen to agree. Something about the phenomenon itself resists the petri dish, the microscope, the rational. And Jule makes a good point. If we're studying the irrational, we must study it on its own terms, not the terms we attempt to impose upon it. In fact, its consistent insistence on not playing by scientific rules is one of the very things we should be trying to understand and untangle, and if you'll pardon the pun, rationalize. Jule published a paper stating this position, and ironically, it was this very paper that led him down the wondrous and cataclysmic path that changed the course of his life forever. In response to his paper, Eisenbud received a letter from Curtis Fuller, co-founder of Fate magazine. Fuller basically said, "You're wrong. There is a repeatable experiment, and it comes in the form of a drunken, elfin bellhop from Chicago named Ted Cirios." According to Fuller, and an article he had recently published in his magazine, Ted Cirios was able to project photographic images onto Polaroid film by simply staring into the camera lens with intense concentration. What exactly were these images? Well, mostly they were buildings. The Taj Mahal, the Pentagon, the White House. So wait, a guy can just apparently think about something and then it appears on film? Well, that's pretty much what Curtis Fuller was saying. My response, Jesus Christ. What do you think Eisenbud's response was? You're wrong. He didn't take the bait. He dashed off a quick, polite reply, and then Fuller's letter went into the trash can. Here's the thing. Eisenbud had been down this road before. A certain amount of professional weariness had set in. Never forget, after a few weeks, every job is a job, and every poltergeist starts to look the same. There is something odd and deeply poignant about someone who can become calloused to miracles. But after repeated entreaties from Fuller to meet with Ted and, quote, see for himself, Jule finally conceded. He was going to be near Chicago in early April 1964. Why not meet with the magic camera dude and cross him off the list? Jule Eisenbud meets Ted Cirios in the lobby of the Palmer House Hotel in Chicago, 8 p.m., Friday night, April 3rd, 1964. Eisenbud describes him as, quote, a slight man in a trench coat. He never actually calls him Rumpelstiltskin, but we get it. Besides Eisenbud and Sirios, present are Jules' nephew John, a 20-year-old budding parapsychologist himself, and Freda Morris, a PhD candidate in psychology who is very familiar with, quote, the Sirios phenomenon. The four of them repair to room 1320 West. Ted would like a drink, a double scotch. Jewel orders it from room service. Ted lights up a cigarette. He asks if he can take off his shoes. He's ready to start. Ted empties his pockets. Coins, keys. He says that metal interferes with his process. And finally, his rosary beads, because Ted's a practicing Catholic. Ted's typical process is to work himself into a deep state of mental, emotional, and physical arousal. Fierce concentration, like a weightlifter attempting to deadlift 500 pounds. Everything focused into a single moment of intense power. Ted's heart rate soars, and then, with the Polaroid Land Model 100 camera pointed directly at his face, he lets out a bellow of effort and snap! He triggers the camera. But that's not what he does now. For his first attempt of the night, he asks Jewel to hold the camera about 2 feet in front of his face. He's going to try to affect the film without activating the camera. He's just going to think. He says his target image is a small dot and a large dot. He concentrates for a couple of minutes, then tells Jewel to check the film. Jewel extracts the print from the camera manually, in the fashion of the old Polaroids, but when it develops, there's nothing there. It's completely black. When a photo that should have some signs of exposure come out completely black, Ted calls it a blackie. These two are somewhat anomalous, but don't worry, Ted's just getting warmed up. And before you ask any questions, Jewel has provided the camera and newly bought film and is controlling it at all times. A few minutes later, Ted is ready to try again, but this time he pulls a small device out of his pocket. A homemade half-inch length of plastic tubing covered at one end by a circular piece of blackened film negative. He calls it his gizmo. He uses it to cover the lens of the camera to limit the amount of light that goes in. Now, this gizmo is the reason that most people are convinced that Ted was faking these pictures all along. If what he's doing is telepathic, and altogether impossible based on anything we know about our physical world, why does he need a gizmo to do it? Hell, why does he even need a camera? These questions go through Jules' mind, but for now, he just wants to see if Ted can do anything at all. He examines the gizmo. Aside from its very existence, there's nothing overtly suspicious about it, no hidden film, just the tube and the blackened piece of blank negative. Jewel hands the gizmo back to Ted, who prepares for his second attempt of the night. This time, Ted holds the camera, aiming it directly at his face. He goes through his process, an intense, almost disturbing level of concentration. Muscles trembling, heart rate soaring. A quick aside, Jewel often had his hand on Ted's wrist during these ramp-ups to monitor his pulse, which sometimes exceeded 130. Okay, so Ted ramps up and clicks the shutter. Another blackie. Third try. Another blackie. Fourth try. Another. Fifth try. Blackie. Okay. So at this point, it's around 10:30, and everyone's starting to get a little discouraged. Jewel is starting to think his side trip to the Windy City has been a waste of time. Ted's getting sweaty. It's time for a break. Ted asks if he can take a cold shower. Sometimes this helps. Jewel says fine. Maybe everybody needs a breather. A second round of drinks is ordered. Scotch for Ted, orange juice for everyone else. The drinks arrive. Jewel hears the shower go off, and then Ted calls to him from the bathroom. Hey, Doc, do you mind coming over here for a minute? Jewel arrives at the bathroom as Ted throws open the door, revealing his naked body to his new friend. Do you mind if I use one of your bath towels? Jewel says, yeah, sure. Did he really need to ask to use a towel? Didn't the permission to take a shower imply that? A lot of guys have deep, lifelong friendships and never see their friends naked. For Jewel and Ted, this threshold is crossed inside of 3 hours. Jewel Eisenbud is thinking, what the hell am I doing here? I'm in a hotel room on a Friday night in Chicago, and here's this crazy naked guy holding his gizmo, and did I really think that somehow this is where I was going to find the holy grail of parapsychology? Ted comes out of the bathroom, fully dressed, thank God. It's 11:04. He quickly tries again. Another blackie. He tries again. Another blackie. Now it's 11:05. 11:05 p.m., April 3rd, 1964. This is the last minute of Jewel Eisenbud's life that will make sense. Of course, he doesn't know that yet. He's getting tired. He's thinking about his wife, Molly, and his kids, John, Eric, and Joanna, back in Denver. He's thinking about flights and cab rides and going home. At 11:06 p.m., Ted tries again. Picture number 8. And what comes out of the camera looks unimpressive. It appears to be nothing more than an oval circle of light with a blurry smudge inside. They all stare at it, searching for anything that can be considered even slightly recognizable. Then Freda Morris screams. She claps her hands and jumps up and down. She knows what this is. It's the Chicago Water Tower. Jewel and John look closer. They turn the print slightly. Son of a bitch. She's right. Now, if you've never seen Ted's pictures, you can go to our show notes and see this one, plus a bunch of others. But for now, let me try to describe them. They're usually blurry. The target is almost always at a canted angle. They often appear to be in motion, with the center in focus and the edges stretching toward us. They somehow feel not quite literal. Even when I first read The World of Ted Cirios back in 2002, it was a simple thing to do an image search on the internet and find dozens of reference photos of the things and places that appeared in Ted's photographs. And when you do this, extraordinary things leap out at you. Ted's pictures are never exact duplicates of existing photographs, at least none that I could find. But by placing Ted's side by side with clear professional images, you can immediately see the similarities. And this is true of the water tower shot. There's an odd, dreamy quality to Ted's pictures. Jewel used the word velvety. They often seem to be taken from impossible angles that would be exceedingly difficult to replicate, even now, much less in 1964. Okay, so we're back in room 1320 West, and it's 11:51 p.m. Ted tries again, and this time the results are even more astounding. It's a street scene at night, and you can clearly see the word Stevens on a sign apparently attached to a building. Everyone can see it, but no one knows what or where it is. Ted suggests it might be the Stevens Hotel. The only problem with this theory is that the Hilton Hotel chain purchased the Stevens Hotel and dropped the name Stevens in 1945. But if Ted is right, he has just produced a photograph of a building and a sign that haven't existed for 20 years. Jewel Eisenbud doesn't sleep that night. He doesn't know what to make of the photographs, much less Ted. And as it turns out, Jewel is not the first person to witness this phenomenon. Ted's been studied by numerous people over the last 10 years. What Jewel can't figure out is, if that's the case, why hasn't he heard about this guy before? Did the other people not get results? The next morning, he starts making phone calls. The first few people he speaks with all say they had some sporadic success with Ted, but none had the appropriate facilities, budgets, or internal agendas to justify continued studies. Fair enough. But then Jewel speaks with someone he identifies only as Professor X, who works in the psychology department of a large Chicago university. Professor X tells Jewel that he worked with Ted and got several pictures from him, though they weren't very clear. But Professor X lost interest when Ted, whose target building was a Miami hospital, came up with, quote, another building entirely. Jewel can't quite believe what he's hearing. Ted's work was dismissed because he got an impossible photo of the wrong building. It's like discarding a talking horse because he only speaks German. Jewel makes a decision more or less on the spot. He's going to work with Ted. He's going to do the work he was hoping the others had done. He's going to be the one to figure out just what the hell is going on. And maybe, just maybe, he's going to make history. Stage 2, investigation. Jewel knows what he's getting into. There is a long history of parapsychologists working with extraordinary people who also happen to be unmanageable. So step number 1 is to bring Ted to Denver, where Jewel can keep an eye on him. At his own expense, Jewel flies Ted in from Chicago. He goes to the airport and is relieved to see Ted get off the plane. So far, so good. But within seconds, it becomes clear. Ted is drunk. Very drunk. Ted tells him it was just a couple of drinks to calm the nerves. And then a couple more when the guy next to him didn't want his. And then the guy on the other side. No big deal. Jewel sets up Ted in a small furnished apartment in the same building where Jewel's office is located. This way, he'll have easy, dependable access to Ted all the time, and experiments can begin immediately. But the next morning, Jewel goes to the apartment, and Ted is gone. The bed hasn't even been slept in. Jewel assumes Ted's been out all night drinking. But where is he now? Sleeping it off on a stranger's couch? At the hospital? In jail? Jewel goes to the lobby drugstore to ask around and finds Ted showered and sober and looking well rested. Ted insists he got a good night's sleep, woke up, made his bed, and went out looking for a church where he could hear Mass. Jewel is glad he's okay, but the notion of controlling Ted, you know, like you would in a scientific experiment, is already beginning to feel a little optimistic. Jewel figures he better start whatever work he's going to do with Ted as soon as possible. On April 16, 1964, Jewel assembles a team of colleagues that he identifies as benign skeptics. Dr. Paul Pollack, a director of psychiatric research at the Fort Logan Mental Health Center. Dr. Joseph Rush, a physicist specializing in optics with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And Ray Wainwright, professor of electrical engineering at Colorado State University, Fort Collins, whose specialty is electromagnetic theory. Wainwright shook things up by surprising Jewel with a fourth observer, Dr. Ralph Baker, a professor of botany and plant pathology. Now, I'm listing their names and professions for a reason. These are all real people who had real professional and academic positions. These were scientists respected in their fields. All agreed to submit testimony at the end of the demonstration, either pro or con, that would then be made publicly available. So, what did these guys think of Ted Serios? Well, pretty much what Jewel Eisenbud thought when he first met Ted 2 weeks earlier. They thought he was a weird guy who could sure put away his scotch. One difference, Ted didn't take off his clothes for these guys, so hey, an improvement. They all gathered at Jewel's office. Once again, it was a long night filled with blackies. But when Ted finally hit, he hit big. Jewel had selected a target for Ted, a magazine picture of Westminster Abbey. It was concealed from Ted in a sealed envelope and locked in Jewel's desk drawer. The idea was that Ted should somehow telepathically intuit the target and then produce it on film. But after a few hours, it became clear this wasn't going to happen. Jewel then revealed the target verbally, but without displaying the magazine photo. Now, excited and sure he could do it, Ted did a series of shots in various parts of the room, and at 10:30, a photo was produced and left to dry in the kitchen area of the office. When it had fully developed, it was obvious something was there. Jewel revealed the target photograph, and sure enough, Ted had produced a credible facsimile of the Westminster Abbey photo. But listen to how Jewel describes it. Quote, It was noticed right away that the image Ted had produced was not an exact copy of a portion of the target picture, but rather an image shot from a slightly different angle and with distinctly different shadows. This would become a hallmark of Ted's photos. They never correspond exactly to other known photos, nor to reality itself. Sometimes a prominent feature of a structure would be missing. Sometimes the spatial relationship of features, such as a row of windows, would be inaccurate. Other times, random details would appear that didn't match any known iteration of the target structure. Ted had the ability to rewrite reality with his photos. At the end of the evening, all four scientists, quote, signed testimonial statements regarding the conditions of trial and observations. Each stated that he was unable to formulate a specific hypothesis as to how the Westminster Abbey picture might have been produced. Dr. Rush took the opportunity to grab Ted's gizmo and take it home with him. Several days later, he returned it to Jewel, having eliminated it as a justifiable source of suspicion. Jewel now had four qualified witnesses endorsing Ted's abilities in writing. He'd taken the gizmo out of the equation, at least as far as fraud was concerned. More important, he now witnessed with his own eyes what Ted could do on two separate occasions under conditions that to any reasonable person would seem to completely rule out fakery on the part of Ted. Ted was doing something impossible, over and over, and Jewel was seeing it happen. Which, of course, leads us to stage three, doubt. Just when you'd think Jewel would finally feel vindicated, he found his mind rebelling against the evidence in front of him. I'm going to quote him at length because what he's describing is important and not uncommon. Quote, "Certainly an attitude of caution and skepticism should be expected of anyone undertaking to test a hypothesis according to conventional canons of scientific inquiry, but not the kind of gnawing, festering doubt that took possession of me. I was to observe this kind of almost obsessional doubt in myself many times in the months to come. I can compare this doubt qualitatively only to the kind of morbid suspiciousness I have seen in lovers and pathologically jealous married people I have seen in my practice. Professional skeptics, well, really debunkers, would have us believe that anyone who allows for the possible existence of the paranormal is a credulous dupe. According to them, parapsychologists simply lap up whatever they're handed without careful reflection. They're wrong, of course, and this is exactly the crisis Eisenbud finds himself in. His rational mind is handed two conflicting pieces of information. One, Ted Cyrios is thinking pictures onto film, and two, Ted Cyrios can't possibly be thinking pictures onto film. Eisenbud goes on to relate the observations of the brilliant psychical investigator Everard Fielding. Fielding describes how even after witnessing paranormal phenomenon that could in no way have been fraudulent, he and his co-investigators would be so compelled by the need for cognitive closure that they would discount the results of their earlier experiments and retroactively construct invented opportunities for fraud, which upon later rechecking were found to be non-existent. In other words, instead of their minds inventing reasons to accept the existence of the paranormal, something skeptics claim people do all the time, in fact, the exact opposite happens. People will consciously or unconsciously edit out information that doesn't conform to their notion of reality, even if it runs counter to their own observation and experience. In this case, dismissing the irrational is in itself irrational. What skeptics often fail to note is their own deeply held need for cognitive closure. That's why any serious investigation of the paranormal is essentially forbidden by these self-appointed gatekeepers of the scientific method. And for the record, the vast majority of professional skeptics aren't scientists. They're stage magicians, hoping to meet Neil deGrasse Tyson one day. The goal of the skeptic has never really been to explain paranormal phenomena. Their goal is to explain it away, to convince the general public that the questions posed by parapsychology are so ludicrous that they require no answer at all. But how's science going to, quote, one day explain everything we call supernatural, if it ridicules the very idea of investigating it? Now, it wasn't just Ted's abilities and how they worked that kept Jewel up at night. It was Ted himself. His drinking was getting worse. He'd disappear for days on end. He'd get into barroom brawls all the time, bad ones, and he was never the winner in these contests. It got to the point where Jewel worried that not only would Ted become so injured that whatever psychic talents he had might be lost, but that he might actually be killed. Ted was constantly arrested for vagrancy, wandering the streets at night. Once he even drove off in the Eisenbud family car, only to be found hours later with a female outpatient he'd taken from the local psychiatric hospital. Ted was eccentric on his best days and completely bonkers on his worst. Jewel was equipped to deal with people who suffered from mental illness. After all, he was a psychiatrist. But handling a patient was different from bringing an emotionally erratic alcoholic into your life and tying yourself and your professional future to them. Ted's mood swings were legendary. Demonic rages one minute, heaving sobs the next, and trailing off into hours or even days of near catatonia. His best moments were typically during his demonstrations, which were often attended by as many as 12 people and carried off in private homes around Denver. He would preside over these like an impish ringmaster, ordering people around, shuffling cameras, orchestrating who would snap the photo, who would hold the gizmo, where he would sit, and who would bring him his next drink. There would often be so many witnesses and so many cameras and so much chaos that skeptics insisted Ted could have run an elephant through the room and it would have been barely noticed. The one thing Ted could not have done, by any known means, was produce the pictures he was producing the way he was producing them. Because it was right around this time that Ted hit a hot streak. It lasted for months. More than 40 working sessions in a row that, without a single exception, produced successful results. And those results comprise some of the strangest, most otherworldly photographs ever produced by a human being through means that can only be described as paranormal. Stage 4, acceptance. This is where dozens, maybe hundreds, of anomalous photos are produced that defy any rational explanation. This is where Ted aims the camera at himself and produces a photograph of someone on the other side of the room, or in another room altogether, or a photograph of a person in a room they haven't been in at all. This is where Ted conjures an almost exact photo of Jules's ranch house, which he'd never been to, and which he rendered in the house's earlier form, from before Ted and Jewel had even met, and for which no exact photos existed. This is where Ted's montage photos are born, Polaroids with overlapping images from various parts of a room, or several different rooms, overlaid with strange partial faces of unknown people. Remember, these aren't photographs created in a lab over a course of hours or days. These are created instantly, one after the other, on self-developing Polaroid film in front of numerous witnesses in a matter of minutes. And it happened over and over again in different places with different people across a span of months. This is the stage we call acceptance. This is where gizmophobia comes to die. Jewel has been writing a book. This book, The World of Ted Serios. And they're nearing the publication date. It's time for the world to see what Ted can do, examine the evidence, and weigh in on what's happening and how. For Jewel, it's a crowning achievement. It's a chance to broaden the discussion about man's untapped psychic abilities. Maybe this will turn the tide and bring much-needed attention and grant money to the field of parapsychology. This one case could change everything. It could spark a revolution. Stage 5, James Randi. I call Stage 5 James Randi for simplicity's sake. James Randi wasn't always the specific person responsible for hurling hog into the wind whenever someone came forward with a story of the supernatural, but he worked so hard to be that guy. The one the world would associate with disproving claims of the paranormal. That it seems only fair to give him his own category. As far as Ted Serios goes, Randy wasn't really much of an opponent, though he tried to be. If you're a fan of Randy, this section might actually be hard to hear. It's not one of his finer moments. But it does illustrate an aspect of Randy-style skepticism that's more about self-promotion than any actual investigation into claims of the paranormal. But we'll get to that. It is June of 1967, and though he doesn't know it yet, Ted is about to produce the last paranormal photograph of his long, strange career. 2 weeks after a disappointing two-day session with writers from Popular Photography magazine that resulted in nothing but blackies, Ted found himself having just as much trouble at a session with a Swedish journalist. In total frustration, Ted punched the back of the camera and then ordered the man to examine the following print. When developed, it was one of Ted's clearer and more recognizable shots, the rippling folds of a curtain. The symbolism didn't emerge until much later, when it was clear Ted's period of bounty had come to an end. But for him, it was curtains. The end. Popular Photography scheduled the publication of their article to coincide with the release of Jule Eisenbud's book. The article, entitled An Amazing Weekend with the Amazing Ted Serios, was more of a hit piece than anything. The article focused on Ted's inability to produce anything near to what he claimed he could do, but then weirdly also emphasized Ted's moody refusal to let the writers, Charles Reynolds and David B. Eisendrath, examine his ever-present gizmo. The article then goes on to spend the bulk of its text discussing exactly how a device, like the gizmo, could conceivably be used to create images on film. Now, if you go on YouTube, you can find Reynolds and Eisendrath demonstrating it on Arthur C. Clarke's World of Strange Powers, so go check it out. The article created the very clear impression that Ted was doing exactly that, using the gizmo to fake the photos. But here's the thing, Ted didn't produce any paranormal photos during the session, so his subsequent refusal to hand over the gizmo, while childish, also doesn't prove anything. He didn't fake anything because nothing was produced. So why the smear? Well, the title provides a part of the clue. An Amazing Weekend with the Amazing Ted Serios. Now, for all his adolescent ego, Ted never referred to himself as amazing. But we all know who did. James Randi. It was then discovered that longtime Randi supporter and arch-skeptic in his own right, Martin Gardner, was behind the Popular Photography visit. Then it turns out, both Reynolds and Eisendrath are not just writers for Popular Photography, but also amateur magicians. If something smells fishy, it's the unmistakable odor of a debunking hit piece. On October 4th, 1967, the amazing James Randi enters the picture. He appears on the Today Show, with Reynolds and Eisendrath waiting in the wings, to supposedly demonstrate how Ted hoaxes his photographs. Jule and Ted were invited to watch, but somehow the demonstration didn't go off as planned. James Randi, a magician who had carefully prepared for weeks to show in a controlled environment how Ted faked the photos, could not do what Ted did hundreds of times in crowded rooms with dozens of hostile witnesses while drunk. Amazing. Scrambling to pull up out of his humiliating nosedive, Randi bluffed. He agreed to submit himself to Jule Eisenbud's test conditions and prove once and for all that Ted was a fraud. What television viewers never saw was James Randi later backing out of that very claim. He never did duplicate Ted's abilities or demonstrate how they could be faked. In point of fact, no one ever has. That never stopped Randi from claiming that he could demonstrate on request just how Ted's, quote, trick was accomplished. Martin Gardner himself stated in print in a review in Nature magazine that as for Ted's photography, Randi, quote, demonstrates it regularly and with more skill. This is absolutely not true. And look, you can sneer at and mock the people who honestly study the paranormal all you want, if that's what gets you off. God knows there's plenty to sneer at and mock. But when you're speaking as a self-appointed arbiter of what is factual and what is fraudulent, lying defeats your purpose. So why did they lie? What could have been so threatening to James Randi and Martin Gardner to make them lie about Ted Cirios? Nothing. They just truly believed he was faking it. They didn't know how, but he must be right. Because if he isn't, then that means he can do something that goes against our current notions of what is possible. And believing that would be irrational. One guy doing something extraordinary isn't something to study. It's something to squish. If thousands of people start doing it, then sure, we'll look at it. But why spend the time and energy studying one extraordinary person? Where's the value in that? Parapsychologists typically fall into two camps. The first wants desperately to be included among the ranks of mainstream science. They want to rush the frat, but are doomed to a life of never-ending hazing. The second group seems to be made up of researchers who are beginning to suspect that whatever it is they're studying may never be fully explained by science alone. After all, it's not called para-engineering or para-physics. It's called parapsychology. And there are many within the club of science who do not believe in psychology or that it should be considered a science. At best, it's referred to as a soft science. A soft science is defined as, quote, a science such as sociology or anthropology that deals with humans as its principal subject matter and is therefore not generally considered to be based on rigorous experimentation. Those pesky humans. If we could just get them out of the equation for a good, think of all we could accomplish. Things like medicine and biology are considered hard sciences because even though they deal with human beings, they deal more or less exclusively with the human body. These other fields, sociology, anthropology, and here I will add in psychology, deal with human behavior. It's interesting to observe that most skeptics argue for a strict adherence to the precepts of hard sciences for any sort of meaningful evaluation of parapsychological evidence or phenomenon. In other words, if it can't be studied in a lab, f*** off. But these same skeptics have absolutely no problem using the rhetoric of the soft science of psychology to explain away parapsychology. They'll talk about how human beings are storytelling animals who are psychologically predisposed to find patterns where there are none. Or they'll go on about mass hysteria, which, by the way, is an unproven concept. It is usually accepted by skeptics to explain away UFO flaps, seance phenomenon, and every ghost investigation TV show that has ever existed. In other words, unproven psychological states will be accepted as a workable theory by skeptics to disprove other unproven psychological states, like mediumship, perception of ghosts, ESP, and precognition. Really, any rhetorical argument is fair game for skeptics to employ if it delegitimizes any real inquiry into claims of the paranormal, which ironically is the one thing they claim to promote. You'd think that a mystery that still needs to be solved would be catnip to a true scientist. And it certainly is catnip to parapsychologists. But the evidence put forth at this point in human history is still extremely difficult to classify. And there is no real working theory as to how or why any of this weird stuff happens. It's easy to get frustrated and dismissive. When skeptics erroneously, or cynically, group people with a serious interest in the paranormal with conspiracy theorists or radical religious leaders, they create a powerful enemy of rational thought that must be vanquished at all costs. A lot of the people I know who have a sincere, and I would say rational, interest in the paranormal do not hold to any radical belief system. If anything, they seem determined to resist belief at all costs. Like true Fortians, which are students of Charles Fort, look it up, they try to follow the evidence wherever it may lead, even if it leads straight into the abyss. Unanswered questions don't scare Fortians nearly as much as questions that are answered too quickly by skeptics on the one side and true believers on the other. Parapsychologists, amateur ghost hunters, podcasters like myself, and professional skeptics like Michael Shermer, Joe Nickel, or the late James Randi, are basically engaged in a territorial dispute about where to draw the line that separates science from pseudoscience. And the battlefield on which we fight is the demilitarized zone of soft science. We're fighting a mostly civilized war and claiming victories in yards or feet or even inches in a conflict we all have a disconcerting fear might last forever. And to be fair, the fight isn't really between skeptics and parapsychologists. It's between skeptics and true believers. They are the binary opposites, but they share an important similarity. They both know the answer to every question before it's even asked. The true parapsychologist doesn't have the answers yet. They are comfortable in the question. In this fight, if it's even a fight, the skeptics have one clear advantage. The questions of parapsychology are not particularly pressing. We're not being attacked and killed by ghosts. There's not a group of people that can suddenly read everyone else's mind. Poltergeists aren't causing a huge downturn in the housing market. All the fringe stuff is still out there on the fringe, for now at least. And if a billionaire was going to give away $1 billion, would I prefer it to be to parapsychologists or to scientists striving to cure cancer? I'm going with cancer. The questions asked by parapsychologists are big and important. But at the back of our minds, we are all probably thinking a version of the same thing, which is, we'll get the answers one way or another when we're dead. Stage 6. Depression. Ted Cirios died in 2006, and for the last 40 years of his life, he never regained his ability to create the eerie, haunting photographs that made him briefly famous. Yet another reason to believe the photographs were authentic. If they were fake, why not keep faking it? He could have made a modest living and gotten the thing he really craved, attention, by simply preaching to the choir of believers and using the gizmo so many skeptics thought was the key to his magic to produce novelty items around the world. But he didn't, because he couldn't. Students of the paranormal are familiar with this syndrome. Many great mediums and psychics burn brightly, but only for a time. Sometimes when their talent wanes, they do resort to trickery and are caught, and their genuine works are swept away with proof of their fraud. Ted didn't do this. Jewel supplied him with cameras and film and encouraged him to keep trying, and he did for years, but nothing. Just blackies. Belief in the supernatural happens to people one at a time. For Jewel, belief came in the form of an impossible person who could do impossible things. In Jewel's own words, "For my part, the work with Ted has changed my view of life and the natural world as nothing else could." Jewel may not have proved to the world what Ted could do, but in the end, it didn't matter. Ted's very existence confirmed to Jewel the worthiness of his efforts. Jewel got his wish. He found his white crow. The crow's name was Ted Cirios, and that was sufficient. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we head to Toronto to hang out on the set of HBO Max's Titans, while I have a nervous breakdown reading Nancy Evans Bush's book about disturbing near-death experiences, Dancing Past the Dark. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.